Excuse me for interrupting, sir, but I don't think the audio has been turned on again at your end for those of us online. If that can be rectified, thank you. It hasn't turned on now. Thank you.
Can you hear us now?
I can now, thank you.
Very good.
Thank you, Your Honour. I'd like to put to the witness a letter from the Ministry of the Environment. 31 July 2023, offering some further help to the Chief Executive Waikato Regional Council, and I have...
Is this in the bundle?
It's not in the bundle. It was attached to a memorandum, two memoranda, one filed by the Director General of Conservation and one filed by the Regional Council, so it may need to have an exhibit number if we get that file. I realise your evidence doesn't deal with the issue of overseer and the various alternative holes, but you are the manager of resource management policy, and so you're familiar with this offer from the Ministry for the Environment, and I'll refer to page 3. Well, first of all, are you familiar with this letter?
No, I'm not.
You're not?
No.
All right, well, I'll seek to have that produced through another witness then.
Is this going to be as important to our discussion as, for example, the documents responding to the overseer model development review and so on that the Ministry has produced that we already do here?
Possibly not. However, the letter talks about assessment criteria for the fit for purpose assessment and a review group which is being set up that may assist councils in looking at the various tools. And I was simply going to ask whether the Regional Council had taken up the offer of discussing
that
matter with the review group.
I don't know if it needs to be produced for that purpose. Just let me check. Is there any objection to this coming in front of the court? Anyone? Ms. Carruthers, any objection to this?
None at all, sir. Thank you.
Well, why don't we say by consent then for the purposes of putting it to witnesses?
Thank you, sir.
Right. So by consent, we will give it a number just so we can keep track of it just in case. And so we'll call this exhibit 1.
And as I will need to ask other witnesses about this, I have no further questions. Thank you, Mr. McCullough.
Horticulture New Zealand?
Yes, thank you, sir. Just one question.
Thank you.
Was I right in detecting you had some familiarity with the incoming NDEA?
A very little bit, yeah. Man, I've sort of helped with submissions on it in the background level, but I wouldn't say I'm really across the detail or really, really familiar with it. Sorry.
Who is? I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. Go ahead.
Are you aware that it contains a reference to needing to give directions on enabling the supply of fresh fruit and vegetables?
I think I've heard that, but I'm not familiar with that clause of the NDEA.
But if you take it from me, there is a section that said that. If enabling the supply of fruit and vegetables is called for by the MBEA, then do you agree it's not as simple in PC1 as saying there can be no CVP expansion, is it?
Sorry, I find that quite a difficult question to answer because enabling might mean some sort of rule framework that controls the expansion of
yes, and if it is done in a careful way, then it could be appropriate to allow for expanded commercial vegetable production, couldn't it?
Well, I understand some of the changes being proposed by Mr. Tribulco do allow for that in a limited manner, so in line with what quality criteria.
Yeah, so it would be overly simplistic to just say, oh well, there's no headroom for water quality issues, so that there can be no expansion. That would be too simple a way of looking at it, wouldn't it?
It's quite a complex matter, I understand, the whole management of CVP, and it's just not in our area, but we're also having discussions with Auckland Council about it to determine how it's managed.
Yeah,
and will be managed in the future.
Thank you. That was all said. And I forgot to enter an appearance for my other client, the Pukekohe Vegetable.
Oh, yes. I assume that...
Who are next, and they don't have a host of contrary questions to ask, so that's all I have. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Ferguson, any questions for this witness?
Just a couple, sir. Thank you. Perhaps I'll start at the end with a question that my friend just asked you in relation to, he referred to a provision of the new Natural Environment Act. I think he was referring to section 129, subsection of G, paragraph G of 129, which states the national planning framework must include contents that provide direction on G enabling supply of fresh fruit and vegetables. So you're not familiar with that?
No.
Were you aware that Te Tiri Whai Mana has expressed provisions within the Natural and Built Environment Act?
Yes, I'm aware that it's referred to in the Natural and Built Environment Act, and I would expect that to be the case.
Yes, and in that section 104, which refers to Te Tiri Whai Mana, and that says Te Tiri Whai Mana prevails over an inconsistent provision in the National Planning Framework, and in its entirety is deemed to be part of any plan made under this Act that affects the Waikato River or the Waipa River or activities within the catchments, and the remainder of the plan must give effect to the requirement. So that sounds a very consistent hierarchy to what we have here, doesn't it?
Yes, that is the hierarchy we have here.
Thank you. And the other question, and again, tell me if I should be putting these questions to perhaps Ms. May or someone, but you've talked here in your evidence and in your rebuttal about the freshwater policy review.
Yeah.
And Ms. May gives evidence about the preparation of PC1.
Yeah.
Are you in charge of the planning process or the policy review process so far as National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management 2020 is concerned?
It falls within my area, yes. I have this project, the Regional Coastal Plan Review, and the Freshwater Policy Review under my area.
Thank you. And you saw that Mr. Bruff for the River Ewing made some comments raising some issues about the lack of reference to the joint planning framework, and you responded to that and said you had referred to it.
Yeah.
And I think probably to be a little bit more specific, Mr. Bruff's concern was that there didn't seem to be a reference to the joint working party process that developed PC1, or an express acknowledgement in setting out the process that the ultimate recommendation of the draft plan to the council must be a joint one between the council and the River Iwi. Do you accept that those are part of the process?
Yeah, that joint working party process was.
Needs to be in place for the policy review.
And it was something that we're trying to get in place, too, because
right.
We are trying to get a joint working a joint committee of Iwi and our councillors in place for that.
And the final draft plan will be a joint recommendation as well to council.
The joint recommendation, well, that's what we're envisaging at the moment, if we can get that through our council, yeah.
Thank you. I tried nothing further, sir.
Thank you very much. Mr. McCurry, any questions for this witness?
Yes, thank you, sir. Mr. McAuliffe, it may be that you refer me to Mr. Trevilco or other witnesses, and that's fine, of course.
Yeah.
So there was some discussion from my friend in terms of, my paraphrase, a consequence of some of the outcomes sought by Mana Whenua to addressing matters of headroom and the like, assuming the assumption or the premise in that question being correct for the moment, is that something you can discuss or better referred elsewhere?
Better referred elsewhere, I think, Mr. Majority.
Thank you.
Now, I think that takes us to the end of the general list. Ms. Chappell, do you have any questions for this witness?
No, nothing, sir. Thank you.
I'm not sure that his evidence deals specifically with any point source discharge matters, and I don't think, other than to the extent that there are parties here who are also involved in point source discharges, we don't have any of the parties present who are otherwise focused on them, do we? No. All right. Any re-examination? No, thank you, Your Honour. Oh, sorry. Mr. Pennell, are you still on the line?
Yes, I am, sir.
Do you have any questions for Mr. McAuliffe?
No, I do not, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. McAuliffe.
Good afternoon.
I'm just looking for clarification on a couple of matters, really.
Yes.
If this court was to decide that the management of nutrient was to be sort of based on overseer or an alternative,
yeah.
Is it your intention to take that directly into the plan change or something different?
We will take the court's direction, because that'll be the latest thinking that we have, so we would intend to take that direction.
Okay, and in relation to the other contaminants, E. coli, phosphorus and sediment, you would take the same findings from the court rather than look to put in some kind of way of measuring reductions?
Yes, that's why this court hearing is so important to us.
Okay, thank you. Will you be making provisions for alternatives to whatever the court comes up with, or will you just say it, that's it?
We will need to consider alternatives as required under Section 32. So, that's what the Act requires of us. But obviously, the court having made a determination in that case would sort of play out make the decision for us, really, as to what direction we're going.
Okay, and there's currently no intention to introduce policies or rules relating to requirement to reduce contaminant discharges at a specific farm level. Is that correct?
That's correct from my understanding, yeah.
So, taking that a step further, that could change through the next plan change process or through a further plan change if found to be necessary. Is that correct?
It could do, yeah. We've got to work through those issues and weighing up all the feedback that we're receiving.
Thank you. And are you doing any further work on offset and compensation requirements, or will that be the same, that whatever this court comes up with, that will be your starting point?
I know there's some work going on in council at the moment, so we will look at that work, but we'll also look at what this court comes out with who, which will determine the direction.
In terms of the freshwater farm plans, is it your intention to do a review of what the, or to start from scratch in terms of your process, in terms of what will go in the next plan change?
No, I don't think we would do it. We'd start from scratch. We've got what we determine through this process and what's come through the national regulations.
But would you try and make them perhaps more linked, you know, with no duplication?
We'd certainly try and do that, yes.
But if that doesn't happen through this process, that's something that you would do?
We would look at doing it through that process if we're able to.
This is a sort of $64,000 question.
Yeah.
Do you have a view when the next plan change is likely to become operative? What's your best assessment of that?
You mean the freshwater policy review? So it's decision's got to be released, I understand, 2 years after it's been modified. And then under the freshwater plan process in the RMA, the appeals are only on points of law, so probably I'd say by mid-2027 it would be, assuming no point appeals on points of law. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Corbett. Thank you.
Anything arising from the Commissioner's question? Thank you very much, Mr. McCord, for your evidence. You're excused.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honour. Next we have Dr. Stasbrook.
Confirm for the court your full name is Michael Robert Scarsbrook?
Yes.
And you've prepared two statements of evidence in these proceedings dated 26 May and 25 August 2023?
Yes, that's correct.
And the first of those sets out your qualifications and experience?
Yes.
Did you have any corrections to make to that evidence? I think it was just the one that was in the...
Yes, there was one correction I was wanting to make, which is page 17 of my rebuttal. Paragraph number 63, where I referred to the collaborative stakeholder group, MCSG, as the consultative stakeholder group. I just wanted to clarify that was an error, just in case the court was worried there was another group out there considering this.
Thank you. And with that correction, do you confirm your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
And you've also been involved in conferencing, I think there have been three joint witness statements to which you're a party, namely water quality, lakes and wetlands. Is that
That's
correct?
Correct.
Thank you. And sir, on the same basis that there's no introduction...
Thank you, Dr. Stasbrook. Would you please remain and answer any questions?
Thank you, Your Honour. Good afternoon, Dr. Stasbrook.
Good afternoon.
I just wanted to look at the wetlands issue for a moment first, and in particular Schedule C. I might take you to the schedule if you can. It's the version attached to Mr. Tribrico's evidence, so I think that's tab 18. You can look at the rebuttal version of plan change one in that evidence, please.
Say again, sorry, Mr. Tribrico.
Sorry, if you could look at the rebuttal version of Mr. Tribrico's evidence.
Sorry, is that the same version that was in our, in the legal submissions?
Yes, we can refer to that one, yes.
Okay. So which section, sorry?
Schedule C, please.
I don't. Can I just stop and put my reading glasses
sure,
on?
Sure, of course.
Sorry, that's better. So it's before the tables?
Yeah, Schedule C. Page 30. Yeah. Slightly different than your version.
Page 40 on the legal submissions version, if that's helpful.
Thank you. I've got it now.
Thank you. And if you could look at clause 2, please.
Yes.
And in there it says 2A, it says 10 metres, this is talking about stock exclusion.
Yes.
10 metres from the edge of any wetland listed in table 3.7.7.
Of the regional plan.
Yes, that's right. And so, do you agree that the best available information has been used to map those wetlands in that table?
So those are the significant wetlands identified in the regional plan currently?
Yes, in table 3.7.7.
Yes, and in the technical caucusing, I think Dr. Robertson for the Director General identified in his evidence essentially an extent of wetlands, and I think there's general agreement that that was the best information available. I noted that in giving effect to the NPSFM 2020, we're undertaking a significant piece of work around mapping of wetlands throughout the region, and indicated at that technical caucusing that what we're finding is that the extent of wetlands is much greater than we currently understand that extent to be, or that is currently in our regional plan or in the FENS database, the Freshwater Environments in New Zealand database that Dr. Robinson referred to in his evidence. But because that's a mapping process that is only sort of really getting underway, we don't have certainty about the full extent of wetlands in the region yet.
Thank you, Dr. Scarsbrook. So I guess what I've taken from that is in the the freshwater policy review, there will be an extension of those maps that have been identified based on the work that you're currently doing?
Yes, to the extent that we have that information available. So the NPSFM provides a 10-year period for regional councils to complete an inventory of wetlands. So to the extent that we have that information available for the freshwater policy review, so updated information, we'll make that available.
Thank you, Dr. Scarsbrook. Just moving along to another issue, if I could just firstly take you to the joint witness statement for water quality. Do you have a copy there? Or?
Yes.
Dr. Scarsbrook, could you just move the microphone a little bit down? You're speaking into it and it's just slightly overloading. We're getting a call. So that should be fine. And we should still pick that up. Don't worry about that.
But so I need to give it a wipe.
Oh.
And so if I could take you to questions 36 and 37 of the witness statement.
So 36 is, do all four contaminants managed by PC1?
Yes.
Yes.
That's the question. So, yes, do all four contaminants managed by PC1 need to be managed to achieve a healthy Waikato River. And of course the agreement there is, yes, all four contaminants need to be managed. You agree with that?
Yes.
Part of your agreement. And then in table, sorry, in part three of that agreement, there are risks with mismatch between subcatchments and scale contaminant priority in terms of any priority approach to managing contaminants.
So that, I think that that relates to the issues around table 3.11.2, which identified a prioritisation of the different subcatchments in relation to nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment and E. coli. One of the fundamental risks that the experts talked about was at a property scale, an individual farming property, for example, may have particular issues around sediment. So they might have significant areas of hill slope erosion, for example, or they might have risky areas around fecal contaminants getting into waterways. So that table 3.11.2, by setting out subcatchment priorities, ran the risk of not giving specific enough information to landowners on what their particular contaminants of risk might be.
Thank you. And so have you had an opportunity to read the planning joint witness statement?
No, I haven't.
I just want to take you to one question in there. So if you could have a look at it's in series 401.
Tab 7 of the same volume that... Oh, there we go.
Yes.
And if you could go to question 21, please.
New implementation method 3.11.3.6.
That's correct. And so in the matters of agreement, if we could go down to the third bullet point, and it talks about the water quality JWS provides useful input to the regional council's decision making about contaminants of most concern in the subcatchments. The water quality experts were not asked to address this particular question, and the planner suggests it may be useful for them to provide better specificity. And so for the avoidance of doubt, the question is, what are the contaminants of most concern, if any, in each subcatchment in PC1 area? Do you consider that the water quality JWS has answered that question?
To some extent, yes. By sort of general agreement that all four contaminants need to be managed, recognising that at a property scale there's likely to be beneficial actions to be taken for all four contaminants of interest at, you know, within each property. I think that does essentially say we need to deal with all four contaminants and we need to provide direction at the property scale. There are general patterns of water quality issues across the region, across the PC1 area, and if I could use sediment as an example, the Waikato River upstream of Narawahia, where it joins with the Waipa River, the river water is much clearer, so much lower sediment concentrations than is carried by the Waipa River. So in general terms, managing sediment issues is less of an issue in the central and upper Waikato areas than it is in the Waipa catchment because of the erodible hill country in the Waipa. But other issues such as levels of the fecal indicator bacteria E. coli, that's pretty much a universal issue throughout the PC1 area.
And so the point needs to be made that what are the contaminants of most concern? They're all of concern. Would you agree?
They are. The original intent
from my understanding of tables re-11 too, was to give some direction to landowners on matters they should be considering with greater priority. Not that they focus on a single issue and forget everything else. It's more about prioritising efforts and when landowners might have limited resource, they could focus their attention on specific actions that might have the best bang for the buck, if you like. But generally, I guess where we are now is thinking about, and particularly in relation to the farm plan regulations, is there's a lot more thought and thinking gone into providing landowners with that catchment context information and also trying to help them understand what needs to be done in their individual farm plan. So it, in some respects, makes Table 311.2 less useful.
Thank you, Dr. Scarsbrook. If I could just move to another question, and that's in relation to, again, in the joint witness statement for water quality, and looking at question 11. That's around the dissolved oxygen target attributes.
Yes.
And so given these events, is there any urgency in providing dissolved oxygen target attribute states for the Lower Waikato FMU? And I just wanted to look at the particular matters of agreement, and in particular, paragraphs 1 and 4, it refers to there in the last sentence about management responses, and in paragraph 4 it talks about triggers values for management intervention. From a technical perspective, what do those mean?
Sure. So this is, and I'm not sure to what extent the court's aware of a major environmental issue that occurred in Whangarino wetland over this last summer and autumn. With the extreme weather, historically high rainfall, we had significant flooding in that Lower Waikato area, particularly in the, in many areas, but in Whangarino, we had significant flooding and also high water temperatures being in summertime. And Whangarino carries a significant load of organic material, both in terms of the algae coming in from Lake Waikare, but also organic material coming in from the catchment. So you had flooded areas, you had high temperatures, and you had large amounts of organic material. What that created was the conditions for anoxia. So the organic material broke down, used up all the oxygen in the water, was sitting there stagnant. That caused significant fish kills. So there were large numbers of fish, both native and introduced species of fish killed. That then triggered a botulism outbreak, an avian botulism outbreak. So that led to a significant effort on behalf of Fish and Game, particularly but with support from the Department of Conservation, Mana Whenua, local iwi, as so Waikato Tainui and WRC to try and address that major issue. Since that event occurred, we've been working on a multi-party response plan. And part of that is putting in place triggers, monitoring triggers to trigger specific actions by the different parties who are in that response plan. So we've been doing some modelling work which identifies certain environmental conditions that when we see dissolved oxygen get below a certain level, that will trigger actions. So that's what we're referring to there in terms of the need for those trigger points. And apologies if that's a bit long-winded, but if it would be interesting in relation to the interest in this hearing around Whangarino.
And so given the severity of the event at the Whangamaringo wetland, do you how would you, I know, and tell me if this needs to go to a planning expert, but how, given the concerns you've explained, what measures can be included in the PC1 and the plan change to address those concerns or to enable those interventions?
In my view, the issues with Whanganui Merino and the wider Waikato catchment are so complex that I'd be very surprised if we could deal with them in PC1. I think they will require a significant political will. I think there is changes necessary in the hydrological regime of the Lower Waikato system. That whole system is tied up with the Lower Waikato Flood Protection Scheme, which protects things like State Highway 1 and other important infrastructure. So to address the issues is probably a, if I can say, a whole plan change in its own right. Notwithstanding that, you know, that there is already a significant voluntary or political and organisational will to see real progress made, I think it will need significant regulatory intervention as well, because to deal with the fundamental issues of the nutrients coming into the system, which are fueling a lot of the issues, is going to need to go much further than PC1 envisages.
And so surely very good, robust implementation methods, for example, to help collate the necessary data to help inform those future processes to help then address these events or to prevent them, surely that's a useful thing in your view.
Yes, and as I say, so the response plan that DOC, Fish and Game, Mana Whenua, Waikato Tainui, Waikato River Authority and ourselves are working on sort of starts that process, but we are looking to put in place a program of work under our long-term plan to essentially set out a long-term response to the issues.
Thank you. And just one final question just around the dissolved oxygen. If for example, trigger values or bottom lines for dissolved oxygen were to be set, say, where and in which FMU or sub-catchment would you see the most need for these triggers or targets to address or manage effects of dissolved oxygen?
So the work we're doing for the freshwater policy review at the moment would identify predominantly the lowland areas of the Hamilton Basin, the Lower Waikato Basin, which includes many of the riverine lakes, and also over into the Waihopiaka as well, so into the Hauraki Plain. So those lowland, low gradient, soft bottom streams are where we see most of the issues around dissolved oxygen. So those are the likely areas that we would need to implement dissolved oxygen monitoring as required under the NPS in 2020.
Thank you, Dr. Scarsbrook. And just one final question around the nitrate and ammonia toxicity targets. As I understand it, you're the water quality expert for the Regional Council informing plans to change one from a technical perspective, and also the freshwater policy review.
So with Plan Change 1, I've been involved from a technical perspective. So I was a member of the technical leaders group, so I've been involved in providing advice on Plan Change 1 right in the beginning. I'm in a similar position to Bruce McAuliffe now, is that I now manage several teams of people who are working on that freshwater policy review. So I have teams of scientists who are involved in the freshwater policy review. I'm helping where I can, but we've got 30 scientists in the science section who are helping as well.
And so with the nitrate and toxicity targets, Are there any plans to have those reviewed in the next freshwater, in the freshwater plan policy from those that are currently in Table 311.1?
In relation to the NPSFM attributes around nitrate and ammonia toxicity, no, not for PC1. I'm not aware of any major review. But many of you will be aware that in the NPSFM section 313 requires the setting of nitrogen and phosphorus nutrient exceedance criteria to provide for other ecosystem health attributes that are directly affected by nutrients or affected by nutrients. So in many cases, the levels of nutrients that, say, might need to be set for other measures of ecosystem health are likely to be more stringent than the nitrogen or ammonia toxicity numbers. So whereas a nitrate toxicity number might be 1 milligram per litre, you might have half of that or a quarter of that being the requirement for a nutrient exceedance criteria for other attributes. So that's where we're working now, is to try and understand what those more stringent nitrogen and phosphorus nutrient exceedance criteria are likely to be, and then we have to then identify where in the catchment they will apply and work from mountains to sea to identify where the most sensitive parts of the catchment are.
And that's all part of the freshwater policy review work, is it?
Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Scarsport. Thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you.
Come on.
I was thought that the other parties were going to go before me, but I'm happy to go next with this witness if you would like.
Well, I was just working through the order that we had previously. I know that was because you had a witness that was out of order, so let me go back to that. Waikato River Authority, Mr. Ryan, are you still on the line?
Yes, but no questions, thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you. Mr. Pennell, I'll come back to you as I did with the previous witness.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Dr. Scarsbrook. Just got a couple of questions for you in relation to riparian management. And so if you'd like to have your evidence in chief available, as well as the provisions attached to the council's legal submissions, that would be helpful. And so could I start by taking you to paragraph 142 of your evidence in chief? And that's Common Bundle Reference 301.
Starting stock exclusion from waterways?
Correct. And so your position is that stock exclusion is important and it can be considered a universal good practice.
Correct.
And in relation to that, that relates to all four contaminants.
Yes, in relation to, so if you think about stock having direct access to waterway, particularly thinking cattle or deer, less so sheep, they have some direct effects from having access to waterways, first of which is they can defecate and urinate directly in the waterway. So that brings in sources of nitrogen, E. coli, and phosphorus, and also their actions on moving around the stream and the stream banks can create sediment problems, erosion of stream banks, etc. So yes, all four contaminants are an issue for stock exclusion.
Thank you. And so you see stock exclusion playing a critical role within Plan Change 1?
Yes.
And if you go to the plan change provisions at page 10 of the council version, the post-conferencing, I think it's being referred to as version, this is reflected in stock exclusion being referred to as a priority mitigation action. If you look at about a third of the way down the page, the first bullet point there.
Yes.
Now, if you go back to your paragraph 142, you then do go on to say that there are some practical limitations and refer to topography and paddock configuration.
Yes.
So on that, I wish to go back again to the council's provisions that you were just with, and if you move further forward through to page 40, Schedule C.
Yes.
And so these are the minimum farming standards that apply to farming activities. The first minimum standard there relates to stock exclusion. And within that, there is a general requirement for stock exclusion, and then with A, B, and then Romans 1 and 2 beyond that, giving some detail as to some of the nuances. So I wish to take you to B, which relates to land with a slope of over 10 degrees.
Yes.
And so this requires, well, sorry, if I go back to paragraph A, that refers to land with a slope of under 10 degrees, and so the expectation is that those areas are subject to stock exclusion. Then in B, it's for land over 10 degrees. And then there are two subparagraphs, Romans 1 and 2, that relate to the use of the adjoining, the paddock adjoining the water body.
Yes.
And I'd like to take you to Roman 2 there. And so this applies to grazing where the number of stock units exceeds 18 per graze hectare within that relevant paddock.
Yes.
And so the basic presumption there is that where there are more intensively grazed paddocks, then there should be stock exclusion. But then the paragraph goes on to say unless, and then there's some further detail. And this relates to unless a farm environment plan prepared in accordance with the regulations and the like, and the certifier appointed has certified that the measures in the farm environment plan will, and then there are three bullet points.
Yes.
So I wish to take you through these three bullet points. So these are the matters that would need to be provided for and certified within that farm environment plan to allow an exception to a requirement for stock exclusion. And so those are outlined there. The first bullet refers to preventing or minimising direct deposition. And then the second and third both refer to reducing sediment loss and damage to bank and stream habitat. There's no particular threshold within those bullets as to what extent of minimisation or reduction is required, is there?
Not from what I can see, no.
And so from a water quality perspective, what level of water quality improvement could you potentially expect where there is a situation that doesn't have a threshold, or what sort of degree of minimisation or reduction might be expected?
Very, very difficult to say, but if you were able to, or sorry, if the landowner was able to reduce the access of stock to waterways through a range of measures, then, and because stock exclusion is a universal good practice, I would consider that any reduction in stock access to waterways is going to have benefits. To what extent those benefits are going to be, you know, significant, I don't know. Ideally, you would exclude stock from all waterways all the time, but that is not necessarily practicable. So, I think if you're able to reduce stock access, that's going to be a good thing.
Thank you, but it could potentially be quite slight as far as the reduction or minimisation that's been certified through those provisions, potentially?
Yes, if the landowner is only doing a very slight, making a very slight effort to exclude stock, then the benefits are only going to be very slight.
Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. We don't have Landcorp or Lockyer here at this stage. Mr. Matheson, could you write it down?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Dr. Scarsbrook.
Good afternoon.
Although I'm here representing sheep and cattle, I'd like to talk to you about fish, and in particular koi carp. And you mentioned that at paragraph 66 in your evidence, I think, initially, 66, 68, 69. Can I also, though, just ask you to pull up one of the statements of evidence from the farming witnesses, and it's at tab... Mr. Bruce Graham, Bruce Cameron, EBD 301041. So if you look behind you, there should be a 301 folder. Can't quite read the colour. Orange. Sorry, 304. Volume 304, tab 1.
And so numerically, that's 304001.
That's great. Thank you. Thanks, sir. And then if you could go...
Bruce Cameron?
Yes, Bruce Cameron. And then if you could go to paragraphs 113 through to the start of the page, paragraph 113. Have you read this before?
I haven't seen this, no.
Okay. Well, I'll just give you a chance to have a read of it. It's not very long, so if you just read paragraphs 113 to 114, and then there are some photos...
Can I just ask for clarification? Is Mr. Cameron a technical expert?
No, he's a farmer. Expert in
farming. Yep.
So you see in there, Mr. Cameron expresses some frustration at the damage to the drains and sediment being generated by koi carp in his drains. And is that consistent? And he mentions in there, it slipped past this proofreader, but he mentions in there that it moves more than 14 times its weight in silt per day. Is that consistent with your understanding of water quality effects of carp?
I'm not aware of that, and... Mr. Campbell doesn't provide a reference for that information, but koi carp are well known as what are termed bioturbators, so they'll move around moving sediment as they feed on the bottom of waterways. So yes, they will disturb sediment quite significantly.
And if the sediment's disturbed when there's a rainfall or a flush event, it'll wash the sediment downstream.
Yes. I've certainly witnessed koi carp on the Waikato River at Hamilton stirring up sediment, and there's a plume of sediment below where they're operating.
So from a water quality perspective, you agree it would be important as part of managing sediment losses across the catchment to address the effects of koi carp?
So sediment that's already in the waterways, yes, koi carp will have a significant effect on resuspension of that sediment. In terms of inputs to waterways from the catchment, that's not something koi carp have any influence over.
No, but you see in there Mr. Cameron's evidence, and I you know, he's expert in the sense he walks past these areas every day. His experience is that the koi carp undermine the stream banks, they cause erosion of the stream banks, which causes additional sediment. Do you disagree with that?
Yeah, and stream banks are a major local source of sediment into waterways. In general, in pastoral landscapes, the sediment often builds up in those stream bank areas, and that sediment has been sourced from higher up in the catchment, from erosion in the catchment. So the fundamental primary source of the sediment is through erosion processes in the catchment. It is then, over time, redistributed by a whole range of factors, including bank slumping, which is going to be exacerbated by koi carp.
So from a water quality perspective, as part of an overall package, it will be important to manage and reduce koi carp for a range of reasons, but including water quality.
Yes. The water quality particularly in the lower Waikato, if we're going to achieve good outcomes, we will have to manage koi carp.
Thank you. Turning then to another topic, and this relates to your evidence in chief at paragraph 143. So that's 301.0098. And I asked your council to give you a heads up on this. I just wanted to ask you some questions about the McDowell 2017 paper. Members of the court, that's in the secondary materials at tab 53. It's McDowell et al. 2017. And that was a nationwide assessment of sediment loss from higher order streams.
Mm-hmm.
That correct?
Yes.
And you say at your paragraph 143, McDowell et al. Undertook modelling to assess the yields of sediment to streams with and without stock exclusion. They found an increasing yield of contaminants with increasing stream order size and catchments dominated by agriculture. Loads from low order streams exempt from potential fencing regulations accounted for an average of 77% of the national load. The study indicates that the catchments of small streams are a significant source of contaminants. So, and I just want to focus on that last sentence. The study indicates that the catchment of small streams are a significant source of contaminants. Do you agree, based on reading that paper, it's really important to understand what the exempt streams were for the purpose of that research?
Yes. In terms of them coming up with a specific number like 77, yes.
Because it's the exempt streams that collectively add up to the 70% of contaminants.
Yes, which is a modelled figure.
Yes. And I raise it, you're aware that other people in evidence have referred to this paper as well, which is why I'm taking you through. You've seen that, Dr. Dupree amongst others.
Yes.
Yep. Do you, and when you're looking at costs and benefits from a water quality perspective of fencing or taking other steps, it would also be important for you to understand whether or not those exempt streams, as referred to in the McDowell paper, to what extent they would have already been caught by the stock exclusion regulations for fencing, yes, or whether they are also caught by the Plan Change 1 stock exclusion provision. Do you understand that?
In terms of making a comparison between Dr. Maple, Professor McDowell's study and PC1, yes.
Yeah. So do you agree with me that the McDowell paper said that there are three ways a stream could be exempt? It could either be less than a metre wide, it could be less than 30 centimetres deep, or it could be on slopes greater than 15 degrees. So those three combination of each of those individual exempting factors collectively would add up to a lot of streams in the PC1 catchment, wouldn't they?
Yes.
And they wouldn't just all be in the high country, would they?
No, they would also be in Bowen country and lowland areas.
And you don't know, based on that paper, how many of the exempt streams were in sloping land and how many were in flatter land, do you?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Are you aware that the stock exclusion regulations, and it came up in my friend's opening submissions, the national stock exclusion regulations only apply to streams that are greater than a metre wide?
Yeah.
So they're called wide rivers, which I think has taken some liberty with language, but so a wide river is so greater than a metre. So anything less than a metre is not caught by the stock exclusion regulation.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. But the PC1 controls on stock exclusion apply to permanent intermittent streams of any size, don't they?
Yes.
Even 10 centimetres wide.
Yeah, I guess it's questionable whether... if a stream is permanently flowing, then it may be a very, very small stream. But at some point, certainly in hill country, very small streams will merge into very small permanent flowing streams will merge into intermittent streams, which will merge into ephemeral streams. So it is a continuum. The 1 metre width obviously has quite a history to it in relation to the Clean Streams Accord from 2002 onwards. But many of these small waterways, if they are permanently flowing, where PC1 indicates that they should be fenced off.
Even if they're 10 centimetres wide?
If they're permanently flowing,
yeah.
And 10 centimetres wide, yes.
So have you read Mr. Breon Berry's evidence?
I haven't, no.
So he's a farmer in the very upper reaches of the Waipa catchment.
Yeah,
on the border between, you know where it is?
Yeah.
So he has, on his farm, he has some streams that are permanently flowing because they're fed effectively by springs. Is that from your water quality work?
Yes.
Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. So
very narrow streams.
Yes.
If one can call those streams. Literally in the centimetres. So under these provisions, they would all be required to be fenced off with a significant setback.
Yes, that's what PC1 is saying. If I could... Sorry, carry on.
No.
I was just going to say, in relation to the paper by McDowell in 2017, the main point of that paper is that when you think of a stream network, it's like a tree. It's what we call dendritic. So it sort of branches off. So you have large branches going right down to tiny little twigs, if you like. And we talk about stream order. So an order one, a first order stream just has itself, it's not connected, there's no tributaries to it. And then second order is where two join together. So what we tend to see is very small streams, those first order streams on the map, have a very significant area within a catchment. So quite a significant area of the whole stream network is made up of those very, very small streams. And so what Professor McDowell's paper is identifying is that when you look at the distribution of all those very small streams interfacing with agricultural land use, that's a significant source of contaminants. So if we want to manage those sources of contaminants, then even those really small streams, i.e. less than 1 metre, it's still relevant to manage those in terms of reducing contaminants.
Yeah, thank you. And as I think you fairly acknowledge, there's also practicality reasons that come into that as well.
Yes. I mean, it's you overlay that that branching pattern of streams onto a farmed landscape, and you quickly run into issues around stock control, paddock size. So there are practical limitations to what can and can't be fenced off and still maintain an operating farming landscape.
Yeah, and there's a lot more than that, but I won't bother you with them. You did raise this. So in your rebuttal evidence at paragraph 70, if we can just go to there. Sorry, I don't have the... Oh, so it's at 301.0135. So this is talking again about riparian setbacks.
Yep, so I consider stock exclusion from waterways, that one?
Yep, so that paragraph 70, that one. And you talk about it being good practice, which I don't think anyone disagrees with, that's sensible. And then you talk about later, and you finish that with the reference at the bottom. I understand the antenna schedule says to include minimum farming standards. I consider the 3 metre riparian setback as appropriate for permanent intermittently flowing rivers, etc. And then you say, I understand this is consistent with the requirements of the stock exclusion regulations. So PC1 goes a lot further than the stock exclusion regulations, doesn't it? It's a lot more stringent.
I think certainly in relation to how it deals with intermittent waterways.
Well, PC1 deals with streams less than a metre, doesn't it?
Yes.
Which the national regs don't.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's more stringent, yes.
Yeah. And PC1 requires all streams to be fenced above up to 10 degrees, doesn't it?
That's my understanding.
Yeah, as opposed to the national regs, which is 5 degrees.
I'm not completely up to date with the
measure. All right, well, I'll ask you one more question, because you did raise the 3 metre size. So the position of my clients is that they have asked for a 3 metre average setback, not a 3 metre minimum. And the reason why my clients have asked for a 3 metre average setback is to deal with situations in gullies where to get a 3 metre minimum setback, you would need to do significant earthworks on the side of the hill to create a 3 metre gap between the stream and the new fence line. And doing a significant cut into the hill to make a 3 metre setback from the stream would mobilise a lot of sediment, and from a water quality perspective would be a bigger risk, wouldn't it?
Sorry, I don't quite follow. Why do you need to do a cut to install a fence?
If you needed to have a minimum setback of 3 metres from the water body,
yes,
there will be situations on a farm where to be able to get that internal setback from the edge of the stream bed to the fence at a minimum of 3 metres, there will need to be earthworks. From a water quality perspective, if that could be avoided, that would be a better outcome, wouldn't it?
Apologies, most of my experience is with fencing on dairy farms, and I haven't seen situations where people have had to do major earthworks to install fences. I mean, that could be different on hill country dry stock farms. I certainly agree that there will be situations where it's impracticable to put a fence in place because of the topography, and I would hope we wouldn't be advocating for sort of the unintended consequences of installing a fence that led to greater environmental degradation. I don't think that's a sensible thing. So, but yeah, I'm not quite sure of the specific situation you talk about that would require major earthworks.
Have you been to any of these high country farms up in the Upper Waipa catchment as part of your residence?
I've certainly visited. I spent many years working on Fodder Fodder, which is in the Hakaramata Ranges, so did a lot of my early research in that area. There are different approaches to fencing, which may or may not require major earthworks. So
what I'm saying is I don't know if major earthworks are going to be required in all situations, but it's conceivable that what you're saying is correct. I just don't know.
But some flexibilities would be helpful.
I think, as I say, if there are situations where, in working through the farm plan, that the farm plan and the farm planning advisor identify risks of adverse effects from putting a fence in place, then I think that there's good reason to question that.
And at the moment, if you don't meet the minimum setback, you need to get a resource consent. There's no flexibility. Would you recommend there be some flexibility?
I guess this is getting into more of the policy.
Thank you, Your Honour. I will try and finish. Are we going till 5, is it?
Yeah, I was planning on going till 5. I want to take a little bit of time just for some housekeeping at the end of that. I have already formed the view not to call on anyone after you finish.
Okay.
But do you have more than 5 minutes? The witness is going to be under cross-examination overnight in any event. So from his point of view, it makes no difference. If you want to take a pause at some stage...
I'd hate us to work overtime on the first day, so I'm very happy to finish now.
Well, if this is a convenient point...
Yes, it is. I'm about to go on to another
one. All right.
Thank you.
Dr. Scarisbrook, I don't know if you've ever given evidence before and been subject to cross-examination where you say, hung up overnight on cross-examination. As I said to Mr. McCall earlier, you shouldn't talk to anyone about your evidence or this case between now and tomorrow morning when you return. I suggest you go home and have a quiet evening and just think about other things entirely. All right?
Your Honour, I have to phone my father. It's his birthday today, but I promise I won't.
Yeah, please don't talk to him about Boyka or fencing, if you don't mind. Thank you. All right. Tomorrow, everyone, I was thinking that unless there are any real problems, we might make a start at 9:30. Is that convenient for everyone? Any problems with that? Again, I don't think we're running short of time, but we may as well use the time that's available. And we can adjust hearing times to cope with any particular circumstances. I just want to check, and I possibly should have done it prior to this witness starting. Is the order that we're going through at the moment convenient for everyone? Does anyone feel there's any problem with the order that we have in this list? No? Very good. If there are any particular witnesses where anyone feels it may be important for questions to be, or questioners to be grouped together, you let me know. Are there any other housekeeping matters that anyone would like to raise at this stage? Ms. Omnes.
Yes, thank you, Your Honour. Just in relation to this list, I perhaps should have clarified earlier. With the fish and game witness, Dr. Adam Canning, that was going to be taken out of order.
Yes.
I sent an email to say that he is no longer able to give evidence, so actually that row can be...
We should take that row out, and you with it. You are still in...
I'm still in later on.
I was going to say that.
Thank you, sir.
All right, so Dr. Canning won't be giving evidence. I don't know if there's any issue in terms of anything that's in the content of that, but that's a matter for you. Any other housekeeping matters at this stage? As I say, generally speaking, at both the end and the beginning of the day, I'll raise the question of housekeeping. I find that it is helpful to give everyone the opportunity to raise anything that may be of concern to them. Or if anyone has any bright ideas about how we may handle things as we go through.
John, could I just ask what the reference for the McDowell paper is?
Yes, the supplementary documents. Are those, I'm not sure if those are the materials that we've got, Mr. Conroy?
Your Honour, there is, I think it's the 500 series. That's right. This is an electronic series of documents.
Yes, no, I understand. And if there are ways in which that can be put in Dropbox or something like that to give us access, we can certainly handle that.
Your Honour, I wonder if someone could send us that document sometime in the next
while. I think that if there's a bundle of supplementary documents that everyone has access to, we'd quite like the bundle.
Well, I agree. I'd just like to read some help.
The documents
series of documents was filed on which day? It has been filed by way of a link that you can download all of those documents.
This is a clean, unblemished copy of the McDowell paper that I've read.
Such
a
mug with props.
I did just note, while we're talking about these bundles, my copies, and it appears to be with my USB stick as well as this, some of the figures, it's interesting, some of the figures in Dr. Stasbrook's evidence have come through without any problem at all, but for example, following paragraphs 151 and 154, the figures seem to have gone missing, but Commissioner Hodges gets preferential treatment and his copies seem to have those. I don't know, again, you might just want to flick through some of these, and again, if I could get a fresh e-copy of Dr. Scarsbrook's first statement.
Yes.
I only really noticed that as we were going through the paragraphs, and I realised that the gaps weren't just to shift paragraphs onto the next page.
Thank you, Sue. We'll check that, and we can we may be able to provide a replacement hard copy for that.
Well, if need be. Anyway, all right. Anything else that you want? Thank you all very much. We'll return at 9:30 tomorrow, and see you all then.
No, it's very, 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 very